This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network Jewish Studies channel. I am your host, Drora Arusi, Senior Director of the ASF Institute of Jewish Experience. Today, we have the honor and privilege to speak with Professor Reva Spector-Simon, who, among other works, wrote the book, The Jews of the Middle East and North Africa, The Impact of World War II. We'll get a little more into your background and the content of the book as we begin our discussion. So, Professor Simon, thank you so much for joining us today. I look forward to really hearing about this. I know that we've spoken in the past about this research and we've expanded upon it a little bit and spoken. So I'm excited to really get into it and share it with our listeners. So let's start with a little bit about you. You worked as Associate Director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University, as well as a professor of history at Yeshiva University. Can you first tell us a little bit about your roles there?
Well, first of all, Dora, let me thank you for inviting me to this interview and bringing attention to this important topic. I'd also like to acknowledge the significant contribution and commend the ASF and the Institute of Jewish Experience for their contributions to Jewish education.
Thank you.
I mean it. At Columbia, one of the projects we worked on concerned minorities in the Middle East and North Africa. And we were able to produce a volume on the Jews of the Middle East and North Africa. It was the Jews in the Middle East and North Africa in modern times. I did it working with Michael Laskier and Sarah Rieger. And it contained chapters on individual countries as well as survey articles on history, economics, literature, music, education, and so on. Both at Columbia and at Yeshiva University, I was interested in developing pedagogical materials that teachers could use to integrate the story of the Jews of the Middle East and North Africa into the general European Ashkenazi-oriented curriculum. At one point, I was talking to a colleague who was involved in taking American high school students on the March of the Living. She found that students had three general reactions, and these were typically linked to their backgrounds. Children of survivors identified immediately. They went to look for names and seeking relatives and so on. grandchildren of American Jews who had come to the United States before World War II had less of a connection. And I identified with that because my parents came before World War II, and my father fought in World War II.
As an American?
American Army, yes, US Army in World War II. And the third group were children whose families came from the Middle East and North Africa and had little to no connection to events. I was really taken by these reactions, especially because the story of the Holocaust becomes part of the Jewish-Israeli historical narrative, it leaves out half of the Jewish community. And the gap between Ashkenazim and everyone else becomes even wider. So I decided that there was a story to tell, that the Jews of the Middle East and North Africa were affected by World War II, and that their story is also a part of the general Jewish Israeli World War II story.
Well, like you mentioned, that's not the mainstream of most research. So where did you find your research materials, or what methods did you use to find the information?
Interestingly enough, much of the material has already been published in books, articles, and memoirs, but not as one unified story. So I decided to put it all together. And in addition to books, articles, memoirs, newspaper articles, I used materials in various archives. For example, the United States National Archives, the British and Israeli Archives, and the American Joint Distribution Committee Archives, both in New York and Jerusalem. And there are also transcripts of oral history interviews that Yad Vashem has done with Jews from various North African communities.
From North African specifically, or also from the Middle East?
They started with North Africa. There's a lot on Libya, a lot in Tunisia.
Interesting that so they don't have anything. Oh, we'll get into that later. Sorry.
Well, they might. Yeah, no, they might now. But I know that when they began, they were really working on, again, Libya, Tunisia, that part of North Africa.
Okay. And you can you mention why specifically Libya, Tunisia? Just.
I don't know. Okay. I don't know why.
I just thought that's where maybe the camps were, and that's where.
Or that's where they had people who would give oral histories, or, you know, people who are interested in those particular countries.
Right. Whatever's accessible. Okay.
Sure.
Okay. So let's go back to the book for a minute, or start with the book for a minute. You start the book in the 1930s with the rise of Nazism and European antisemitism in North Africa, particularly Algeria. What do you think was the appeal of European antisemitism in Algeria?
Well, first of all, we have to remember that during the 1930s, politics changed not only in Europe, but also throughout the Middle East and North Africa. It was an era of nationalism and independence movements. Countries under British and French rule wanted independence from their colonial overlords. And some of them looked to Germany as a role model, because Germany didn't have colonies in the Middle East and North Africa. And Hitler stood up to Britain and France in the 1930s. At the same time, French anti-Semitic political parties penetrated North Africa, especially in Algeria, which, don't forget, Algeria had been politically part of mainland France since 1848. The three northern provinces were French. The European settlers the French encouraged to settle there opposed the 1870 decree that granted Jews, Algerian Jews, French citizenship. Throughout the 1930s, Jews, especially in Algeria, found themselves caught between the French settler community that didn't consider the Jews French, and the Muslims who identified Jews with their colonial overlords. In addition, European anti-Semitic literature appeared in the Middle East, where there were already residues of Western-style Christian anti-Semitism. There were notably the blood libel of Damascus blood libel of 1840. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion was translated into Arabic, and Mein Kampf was serialized in Arabic newspapers in Iraq and in North Africa.
And all this was happening in the 1930s or before?
It started the end of the 1920s. And by 1938, There were Nazi party cells in Lebanon, Iraq, Egypt, Iran, Afghanistan, Tunisia, Turkey, and the British Mandate in Palestine. And I live in Jerusalem, for example, near a street called Emek Rephaim, and that's where the head of the Nazi party used to march up and down during the 1930s, until the war.
Sorry. Yeah. So let's go. You keep referring to World War II, and you're not referring to the Holocaust. Can you speak? I know it's a little more than semantics here. So if you can speak to why you called the book also The Impact of World War II rather than the Holocaust.
Because clearly the Holocaust resulted in the slaughter of European Jewry. But while it is true that the Jews of the Middle East and North Africa were not annihilated, but don't forget Jewish communities in the Balkans, Greece, and Rhodes were wiped out. The war, World War II, had a profound impact on the lives of Jews from Morocco to Iran.
And so if it wasn't necessarily a Holocaust and it wasn't connected to the same, why was there a difference between the Jewish communities and the Muslim communities in those? The impact of the war hit North Africa and hit the Middle East. Yes. Was there a difference specifically with the Jewish communities in those in those countries?
Everybody suffered from the war, from food shortages and deprivations. Excuse me. But the war affected Jews from Morocco to Iran directly. For example, there were bombings and invasions. Libya and the Palestine Mandate come to mind. Haifa was bombed, Tel Aviv was bombed by the Italians, and people died. I mean, there were heavy casualties. There were anti-Semitic regulations in French-occupied territories, similar to the ones in mainland France. There were forced labor and deportations in North Africa. There were internment camps in Lebanon. We don't think about that. There were internment camps in Turkey. And there were attacks on Jewish communities, notably the Baghdad community in Iraq. So that's point number one. Point number two.
Can I stop you for a minute? The deportations were to where?
Deportations were camps in the countries.
Okay.
After point number two, after June 1940, when France surrendered to Germany, Britain stood alone fighting the Nazis in Europe. And we hear a lot about Britain standing alone fighting the Nazis in the Blitz and so on. But they were also fighting the Nazis in North Africa for 2 years. There was a back and forth war in Libya between the Axis forces, the Italians and the Germans, and the British who controlled Egypt. The goal was to drive the British out of Egypt. In May 1942, German forces reached the borders of Egypt, and had they broken through, the Nazis would have taken Palestine, and Jews there and in the rest of the Middle East and North Africa would also have been annihilated.
And you mentioned, I'm going to go back to the camps for a minute. You mentioned that they were deported to the camps in their countries. When we think of camps in World War II, we think of the concentration camps, we think of the extermination camps. What kind of camps are you referring to here?
There were internment camps and labor camps, and I'll get to that a little bit later. But I think the bottom line is that the Nazis did not have time, nor the logistics to build annihilation camps in North Africa. Were there plans? Yes, there were plans in Tunisia, and the Germans controlled Tunisia for a bit, but they sent people from the SS there, but they didn't have the time, and nor the logistics to deport people to mainland Europe.
Okay. So you've referred already tangentially to the Farhud and the camps, and people don't talk about it very much. Can you expand upon it a little bit?
Sure. The Farhud, or the attack on the Baghdad Jewish community in June of 1941, was a shock to the Iraqi Jews because they were the most Arabized Jews in the Middle East and they felt at home in Iraq. The attack occurred when Iraqis lost a short war against British forces in May of 1941. The Brits had by treaty military bases in Iraq. At the time, the Iraqi government was backed by pro-German Arab nationalist military officers and the Mufti of Jerusalem, who had found sanctuary in Baghdad after fleeing the British in Palestine. The Iraqis negotiated with Berlin for support for the war, but they didn't receive it in time. As the retreating soldiers moved toward Baghdad, mobs in the city attacked the Jews on June 1st and 2nd, which coincided with the holiday of Shavuot. People were dressed in their holiday finery and they were out and about. The attack, or the Farhud, as it is called in Arabic, resulted in the deaths of 180 Jews. Some 500 businesses were looted and more than 900 buildings housing more than 12,000 people were pillaged. Some Jews fled to Iran, some went to India, but few could enter Palestine because of the immigration restrictions of the British White Paper. By the end of the summer, calm was restored, but nevertheless, the Farhud was a traumatic event for the community and has had a lasting impact until this very day. With regard to camps, labor and internment camps, thousands of Jews were sent to internment camps or worked as forced laborers, especially in North Africa. And there's no record of many of the internees because men who were stateless were, as a result, invisible to foreign relief organizations. And also, the camps opened and closed, names changed, and we really don't have an accurate record, of, especially in North Africa, of how many camps there were and how many people were interned. Now, during the 1930s, there were internment camps in southern France near the Spanish border. And these were set up for political prisoners and thousands of refugees fleeing the Nazis from Germany and Austria. But when France capitulated to the Nazis, camps were also set up in Morocco and Algeria to intern primarily European Jews. And these included demobilized Jewish soldiers who had volunteered to serve in the French army, Algerian political prisoners, refugees taken off of passenger ships, and people who had managed to find shelter in Algeria. Men were also sent to work on what was known as the Trans-Saharan Railroad, a French plan to link Algeria and sub-Saharan Africa, where these men had to lay track across more than 1,000 miles of desert, working in conditions of extreme heat during the day, bitter cold at night, living in crowded camps with little to no shelter. And they were often guarded and tortured by anti-Semitic former legionnaires. Similar camps were set up in Tunisia in late 1942 when the Germans assumed control. There were also Italian camps in Libya. The most notorious was the Jado camp near Tripoli, where men, women, and children were sent. Some 562 people died of typhus. Some Jews were also deported to Italy and later to Bergen-Belsen. I think I should say a word about camps in Turkey because nobody really knows about labor camps in Turkey. And the camps were set up in Turkey to intern people who did not pay the wealth tax. During the war, the Turks imposed a horrific wealth tax on minority communities, and Jews ended up paying pretty much more than anybody else. These are people, Christians were taxed, Armenians were taxed, Jews were taxed. If you didn't come up with money, then the breadwinners were sent to labor camps and your household goods were sold off to the highest bidder. Stores, companies, houses were sold to Turks, for example. It wasn't the fact that the camps were so terrible. The fact was that the incident, the tax and the deportation decimated the community economically. And the Istanbul in particular, the Istanbul community was never the same after that. And you began to see people emigrating from Turkey as a result of that tax.
So, kind of pivot a little bit because I
we're talking about things that I think people don't know about so much, and things that I was excited to read about as well. So we often overlook the strong females in our history. So I was really excited that you were writing about Helene Benatar. And can you share with our listeners a little bit about her?
The heroine in Morocco was a young Jewish attorney, Helene Cazes Benatar, who began assisting refugees during the summer of 1940 and didn't stop. It's estimated that Benatar was instrumental in aiding tens of thousands of European refugees. She intervened with civilian and military authorities, provided necessary guarantees, and arranged for exit visas, housing, and medical treatment, often working in cooperation with international aid organizations, including the American Joint Distribution Committee, HIAS, and later with the Quaker American Friends Service Committee. After Operation Torch, the Allied landing in North Africa in November 1942, she worked with the Allied authorities to release internees from labor camps and to provide housing and jobs for them. People who've written the most about Benatar are Michal Ben-Yaakov, who has written a number of articles, and most recently, Susan Miller, in her book, Years of Glory, has written a biography of Benatar and her work during the war.
Interesting. Yeah, I want to make sure that we highlight, because it's not often that we get to highlight the women. So thank you very much. I want to repeat that this book came out by Routledge in 2020. It's available also in paperback, which is a nice little addition. We talked about that from the beginning. So it's definitely affordable. And it's called The Jews of the Middle East and North Africa, The Impact of World War II by Professor Reva Spector-Simon. So before we conclude, we always like to ask, what's next? Where are we going now?
Well, I'm sort of looking into the American Jewish involvement in the 1948 Israeli War of Independence. So that's about it. I just started looking into that, and there's a lot to look at.
And that'll be interesting in the context of the American perspective on World War II and the Holocaust. So I wonder how.
Yes, there is.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. We greatly appreciate it. And we look forward to having you again on the New Books Network.
Thank you very much, Dora.
Thank you.
Shana Tova.
Shana Tova.